welcome, folks, to another episode of Mention and Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons. This is actually the final episode of this season, so we've made it to the end of the season. And tonight, joining a crew of folks that we'd had over the course of this season that were podcast rookies, we have another new voice on Mention and Dispatches. We are joined tonight by Keith from Wargame HQ. Howdy, Keith.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Doing okay. You know, as always, like, we record this in the evenings, and so we always say good evening, you know, good night to the audience. We don't know when the hell they're listening to it, but, you know, it's tough to be that generic about good day or whatever, so.
Right, it's good evening somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I wish it was an adult beverage in my hand. but the, so yeah, we've got Keith joining us for the first time. And we're going to ask a little bit about Wargame HQ here, but Keith, let me ask you, what was the last war game that you saw something from on social media and just thought, oh my God, I got to have that, and then went out and just found it right away, got it ordered, and couldn't wait to get your mitts on it?
Wow, that's actually a tougher question than you might think. So I have a pretty massive collection of war games as is. Now, that's not a deep library in terms of timeline, but I'd have to say it was probably it might go all the way back to like Longstreet Attacks, because I don't think that was a game that was on my radar necessarily, and as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, I've got to have it. It's got the Rick Barber maps. It's the Blind Sword system. I don't know what I was kind of poo-pooing this or waiting around on it, because I had Stonewall Sword already. And then I was like, nah, I've got to get this. And went out immediately to go and find that one. So it's been a little while. I'm like a pre-order junkie, much to the dismay of my wife. But so most of the time, I have things that I've got, you know, that are here still in shrink and haven't had anything done with them. So, for example, the Deadly Northern Lights just came in like late last week, I think. And so, you know, that was one where I kept seeing all of this stuff from, you know, Less Than 60 Miles. And, of course, before that, I'm blanking on the name of the first game in that series.
Under an Iron Sky.
Yeah, Under an Iron Sky, right. And so I was like, oh, I've got to get this expansion. I don't want to miss it, because I had the first, and I was like, okay, I gotta do this. And so I wasn't sure what was going to happen. And then with all the coronavirus stuff in Italy, I was like, geez, I hope this guy's able to pull this off. And,
yeah.
And he was. It was really spectacular. So yeah, typically I'm kind of ahead of the curve on that kind of stuff, but you know, this was one that just caught my eye, and I was like, oh, I've got to do it. Because I was kind of like, I like Gettysburg games. I have a ton of Gettysburg games. Do I need one that's just second day? And I was like, oh, I definitely need that.
Yeah. Just frame the map and hang it on the wall.
Exactly.
Yeah. You can do that with Rick Barber maps. So I'm curious. So you've got Under an Iron Sky. You do or don't have Less Than 60 Miles?
I do, yeah.
You do. Okay, and then, so you just got Deadly Northern Lights. We were talking about that one last week or the week before when we had Mo on the podcast from Mo's Game Table. Mo was here with us. And I managed to miss both of the first two, which is a little insane, because they're like, Cold War goes hot in Europe. Those ground combat games over the terrain where I used to live are something that's usually just an auto purchase for me. But Under an Iron Sky came out with both a ginormous price tag at a time when my job situation wasn't very stable. And sure, I had to take a pass on it. If it comes back around, I'm going to figure out some way to move heaven and earth to be able to get, because they're talking about a possible third printing of it now. And so I will figure out a way to get Under an Iron Sky, even though I may only ever play it at a game convention. I still think Mo has talked me into it. Ditto with Less Than 60 Miles, which is a similar topic, but not the same system, because it's an echelon, right, or two lower, as I understand.
Yeah, different scale, right? It's a little more tactical, not quite tactical, but
But the less than 60 miles, if I recall correctly, the terrain where it happens is literally right on top of one of the places where I used to live for a while. And so one of the things that I've always enjoyed about some of those Cold War Goes Hot games is to pull them out and then to immediately have the rampaging Soviet hordes invade towns where I used to live.
Yeah, that would definitely put a different twist on it. I always look at these town names, especially like village names from Germany, and I always think, did they make this up? This doesn't seem real.
Yeah. Well, it's once you spend a little time in Germany and you get to know the language some, it does make a lot of sense. You can completely take a town name apart and fully understand exactly what they're referring to with them. That it's, you know, the main town near where we used to live for a while was a town called Herborn. And some folks back in the late 80s had heard of Herborn because there was a big tragedy that happened there at one point, not long after we had moved back to the States in the late 80s. There was a tanker truck that was coming into town and had kind of lost its brakes and ended up going out of control over one of the river bridges right there in the middle of town and crashed into a pizzeria and blew the building up.
Oh, no.
It wasn't a terror or anything. It was just a bad industrial accident, basically. And so some folks had heard the name Herborn on the news for a little while there. But the outlying towns around Herborn were all Herborn-something. And so there was Herborn-Burg, and we lived in Herborn-Selbach. And so they were all Herborn-something. And that's just the way that the town names happened to be named around there. But that's not uncommon. One of the other famous towns in Germany is Oberammergau, which is the place where the Passion Play takes place. Every 10 years, they do the Passion Play up there with the Passion of the Christ. And at one point we were living there, it was an anniversary year, so they were doing a special series of the performances that was outside of the normal 10-year cycle. I want to say it was the 300th or 350th anniversary or something ridiculous.
Wow.
But there's Oberammergau, which is the Oberammergau. And so, you know, you're looking around the map to try and find Unterammergau, which is the lower, you know, and so there's upper and lower and over and under, and you get all of those prefixes stuck on town names all over the place. That's just normal.
So I learned something new tonight. That's awesome. I had no idea.
Yeah, and the rest of our audience has fallen asleep at this point. So
nothing makes for great podcasting than describing maps.
Yeah, well, we need some video at some point, but not tonight. Not with the COVID hair going on. So yeah, the quarantine hair don't care shirts that House of Swank has downtown. I gotta get me one of those. So tell us some about Wargame HQ. It's been around for a couple of years now. As I understand, it's just you that's on the crew there. It's not like you've got a staff of dudes with you.
No.
How'd you get started? Why'd you get started? What's kind of the shtick at Wargame HQ there?
Well, so it originally started quite a while ago, actually. I did a project on Board Game Geek and did a blog entry every single day for a year. And managed to hit every single day. In the end, I added up all the words and looked at how long it would have been if it was a book, and it would have been like a 700-page book of blog entries. And then I just kind of got tired of Board Game Geek and seeing the same battles going on in just cycles every few years around, is this a war game? Is it not a war game? What is a war game? Do you round your corners? What kind of counter clipper do you have? I mean, just the same conversations. And, you know, it's a great entry point for people, but a lot of the kind of anchor community members who were driving new discussion were leaving, or people were retreating into just participation inside of the specific game forums where they were seeking support, and that was great. It was a great place for designers certainly to, you know, capture attention with the folks who were really enthusiastic about their games. And I ended up just like deleting my blog, all the entries, deleted my account, all this stuff, and just kind of abandoned the site and was like, I don't need this. And after that, I took some time off, just was still playing games and stuff like that. Wasn't doing any sort of like writing or, you know, photography or video type stuff. And I thought, I really want to get back into doing this. That was kind of fun. I don't want to do it every day, but it was kind of fun and I need a site to do it. And so I started a site called Games on Tables and did that for a little while and tried to move some of the content that I still had on my computer and reposted that and, you know, did some work there. At one point, Callendale reached out and said, you know, we're kind of abandoning these forums as well. Can we host a forum on the site? And I said, sure, why not? When it was clear that there wasn't going to be any like content moderation on that forum, which was one of the kind of core features of it, it was called the Gamebox forums, I think is what it, and I think it's still around somewhere or another.
I was a member at the Gamebox for a little while. I was never a regular member, but I was a member there. It was the same time that I was running my other site that, but I would pop in and chat with those guys a bit. I knew a lot of them from Board Game Geek. I didn't realize you were the Games on Tables dude.
But so, you know, my job at the time, really started to crack down on what, people who were in leadership positions were doing outside of work that was public. And a lot of the posts that were in the kind of AWOL forum that was just sort of like off topic stuff were really getting into things where like, if I was linked back to what was posted there, and not that it was anything bad, it was mostly just like raunchy type stuff.
Yeah.
But like it was in a place where I felt like, I really can't have this, and I don't really want to run this website anymore. And, you know, so I helped Enrico find a new host, helped him transfer all the data so that it would be a clean transition off the site, and he would have his entire database and records and files and all that stuff that had been created. So we helped with that, you know, data migration for him, and I shut it down. And so again, like another like year or two went by and I said, well, I'm going to do this War Game HQ thing. I'm like, I'm going to really do it this time. I went out and started an LLC. I had all these kind of plans for what I wanted to do and how I wanted to structure content, and started going out and building all this content and stuff like that, and ended up getting another shift in my job responsibilities at work that just absolutely sidelined everything I was doing except for spending time with my family and working. I mean, it was like, and there was just no break. It was like 7 days a week of that. So I took some time off from the site and started writing again last year, and realized, you know, I had an issue, I think, with one, what I was trying to produce, and then two, what I was trying to achieve. And I think there are places that you could go to find great coverage of war games that can be played in an afternoon or an evening or even a single day. And they do such a good job of that coverage already. I don't know that everybody needs three or four different reviews that are all praising the same game or providing virtually the same coverage. And I think that, not that there's too many voices, but it can get crowded if people are all kind of saying the same thing. So I wanted to find something different and really started to look at, is there room for somebody who's just doing like op-ed pieces? Is there room for somebody who's going to do commentary just about wargaming in general, or trends, or, you know, kind of building lists of things that people, you know, might find useful? And there just really isn't too much of an audience for that kind of thing, I don't think. There are a handful of people who will take a look at it and be like, oh, okay, that was a good 10 minutes, fine. But not enough to like bring people back to the site. So I thought, okay, well, you know, what's one of the things that I'm seeing that, you know, just needs to happen? And frankly, I think there are just so many good people covering large games too. So certainly, not to, you know, single anybody out, but I really do think Big Board with Kev Sharp just does a phenomenal job of showing lots of complicated games that can't be tackled in a single day in a video series format that works really well. And I think he's just really, he's smart and interesting, which I think helps. And I really respect guys who are out there doing that. And he's just an example of one of a few. It sounds like you had Mo on here earlier. Mo's another guy that does same thing. Ard Wolf's a guy that does same thing. But there's a bunch of them that cover games with some serious depth and interest behind what they're talking about. And so that really impressed me as well. I thought, okay, well, what's really left? And started thinking about, okay, well, maybe I'll do a podcast. So last year I got a bee in my bonnet to do a podcast called Hexy Talk, recorded 5 episodes of it. I still have those 5 episodes unproduced. We finished recording them in, like, I think early January was the last one that I recorded. And the problem with getting them produced is that the audio quality is just not where I want it. So I listened to, in particular, Harold on Games, and the audio quality is just pristine. And I fully realize that most of the time he's physically with somebody, and that definitely helps the audio. But there were just things in the audio that I didn't like weird hums or just strange background noise is on, probably some of it's on my end, probably some of it's on the other person's end, but I just couldn't get over it. And so I'm still hunting down, like, if I get this plugin for Audacity and then, you know, try to modify this, the way that this audio is being produced, maybe that'll fix it. Or maybe this bit rate's going to eliminate some of that high end noise. And it's just, it's like driving me nuts. And I don't want to put something out that I don't like. And I hate the fact that there's a bunch of really good, interesting stuff in there. And I may just throw it out almost unedited and say, hey, sorry for the audio quality, but these people had some really interesting things to say, and I want you to hear it, because they are, everybody that I interviewed was super interesting and had a lot of cool things to say that we don't often hear interviews with, because my take was there's a lot of folks who are already covering designers and kind of bigger, more established names in the community. And so I really wanted to focus on who are the folks that are just out there posting on social media, and let's talk to them about what they like or don't like and find out what their wargaming experience is, because I think that's more indicative of what the community's up to than what a handful of designers are kind of tossing around. So it gives you that great perspective that's a little different from what you're going to get in other podcasts. And I think that's what's exciting, because what I really like about wargaming is that in particular Twitter, which is where I participate most, I feel like people in general don't get into the same battles and turf wars that they do elsewhere. I think people are just generally supportive of one another, and I like that about the community. When I do see people getting a little, you know, fired up, my hope is that if they can understand the person behind the screen name, they'll be less likely to do that and maybe give folks the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, good luck with that. It's Twitter.
Wargame Twitter's been surprisingly less conflict-filled than many other Twitters.
Yeah, no, that's a true statement. Right down to the part about it's surprising that it's less conflict. Not because they're wargamers, but because Twitter, you know.
Yeah, right. I think there's some – that anonymity just absolutely breeds people – trying to, you know, one-up one another or just not give folks credit for, like, this is a lousy format and people are bad at communicating. So asking them to do it in a concise way is, like, only exacerbating the problem.
I'm fascinated by the whole, you spent an entire year writing a blog entry a day at Board Game Geek and then went and deleted it. I hope you backed those things up somewhere, that you've got the record of that 20 years from now, you can go back and look at that and go, man, there was an accomplishment, you know.
They're gone. It's like if I did my best work as an ice sculpture.
That's a great analogy, but damn, they're gone.
The good news is there wasn't anything in there that was, like, particularly interesting. I think it was more just that it did prove a point that if you publish content every day, people will find it and they will find a way to appreciate it and react to it. And I think that predictability has just been something that I've, you know, really valued with Armchair Dragoons as well. I mean, y'all just crank out content, and that is not easy to build, write, think about. I mean, you have the benefit of even editing what you do. What goes up on Wargame HQ is almost never edited. I'm like, I barely had time to write this. I'm definitely not going to spend another equal amount of time or more trying to edit it and make it beautiful. So I suspect there's probably a good chunk of folks out there who are like, oh, I didn't realize that guy had English as his primary language.
Well, thank you. One of the things that we have going for us is we are the Armchair Dragoons, plural, right? There's a crew of us that are doing some stuff that it doesn't all fall back to me. I've been caught in that content mill grindstone before, where I felt a necessity to have something new every day, and it drove me nuts trying to get there, to the point where, you know, in a past life, there were some fairly goofy things that we were doing just trying to have something new every day. I burned myself out a bit on that. And so when we launched the Dragoons, one of the key things that I promised myself, and that a couple of the guys that helped me run the site also promised they would keep an eye out for me on, is that I wasn't going to get stuck in that, where I felt I wasn't going to drive myself nuts if we went like 5 days without something new showing up, that sometimes stuff just happens and you got to deal with it. And so it's worked out. We've been able to maintain a reasonable pace without driving me bat crap crazy. It's starting to pick up now a little bit, because we've had a couple of guys that had taken some time off for themselves now coming back and providing not just some new content like they'd done before, but actually really ramping up to some higher quality stuff like they had done for us in the past. So I'm really looking forward to, I'm hoping that by the time this goes live, we've got some of our more extended AARs starting to show up. One thing that I do know that will be started by the time this one goes live, I reached out to a whole bunch of friends of mine that are not just designers, but guys similar to what you had done with some of the social media folks, some people that I know through Wargaming. There are some designers in there, but there are some designers that are a little more in the background. There's some developers, there's some guys that do kind of code stuff on the back end for some computer games. There's some guys that use games in a professional context, like in military training context kind of stuff. And what I've done is I've got a whole bunch of questions about sort of game design and some thoughts about gameplay kinds of things that, with this group, it's kind of a panel almost of about 20 odd people that I've sent them a half a dozen questions each, and I'm kind of collecting the answers. So if we're talking about, you know, gamey tactics, what are some times that you've seen where people exploited a loophole in the rules to do something that wasn't really historically accurate, but the game sort of allowed you to get away with it? And talk a little bit about that, and how do you hedge against that in the design or development of a game. And so I've got answers from like a half a dozen dudes that, you know, have a deep well of experience in wargaming to draw on. So we're going to start kind of sharing a lot of their answers. So when we throw that question out there, yeah, I'm going to have a half a dozen or so answers from different people in the wargame world out there. I'm really looking forward to this. I'd done something similar to this, 10 years ago when I was... I had a thing on Blogger for a while. It was called Grog News, and it was a mixture of some war game stuff with a lot of current events, defense, national security kind of things. Again, kind of burned myself out a little bit trying to make sure we had new content every day, and it was kind of driving me nuts some. But this was one of the things we did, where we threw out a whole lot of things with asking folks for, hey, what do you think about this within war game design? What do you think about this in game design? And we got some involvement, some engagement from some people, but not as much as I was really hoping for. So I'm hoping that by having people that are actually in the industry offering their thoughts as a starting point for that conversation, that it can sort of grow and morph and get a lot more dialogue around some fairly directed topics, instead of just throwing a blank slate out there and saying, hey, what do you think about wargame design? Like, let's get into some details with it, you know. How do you treat engineers on the battlefield? What are the things engineers can and can't do, should and shouldn't do, and how do you put those guys on the battlefield? And so let's dig into that a little bit. I'm interested to see where it goes. I've, you know, I, like I said, I had 22, 23 different folks that I had reached out to that said yes. I reached out to a whole lot more. I had about 22, 23 come back and say, yeah, sure, send me the questions. Let's see what we get. And I probably got about 15 or 16 of them back so far. So I'm doing a little better than I thought I was, actually. I thought I was going to do. We're going to start running those. I think on Mondays is when they should start appearing. The first one should be up by the time this podcast goes live. So I'm looking forward to seeing where that takes us. I think one of the big differences between what we do and what you do is I've got a crew of people doing stuff, whereas you're out there flying solo, and that is damn hard to do, because I've tried that before, and I am very impressed by the fact that you haven't gone nuts yet.
Yeah, I'm getting there, I'll tell you what. Well, the other tricky thing, too, is that, you know, my tastes really vary in gaming, and so, you know, I've been gaming since I was like 10, and I'm not exclusively a war gamer, even though that's my love and that makes up the vast majority of my gaming collection. But I also really do enjoy kind of skirmish level miniature games. So, you know, I played a lot of, you know, X-Wing with my son and Star Wars Armada. There's a new game from, I think it's Atomic something games, Atomic Mass Games, I think is what it is. It's Marvel Crisis Protocol. That's a superhero skirmish game. So, you know, I've taken time to enjoy putting those miniatures together and assembling those. And, you know, that part of the hobby I really do like. There are big gaps when I'm kind of devoted to something that really doesn't have necessarily a home on Wargame HQ, which was why I originally had been like, oh, well, you know, I'll do games on tables, because then if I do Wargame content or do whatever, I can write about whatever I want.
Yeah.
Or whatever happens to be on my table at the time. But the reality was, if you don't have some kind of focus, just you talk to nobody. And so I really wanted to make Wargame HQ, you know, primarily about conflict simulation gaming in whatever that kind of looks like. And so particularly historical or hypothetical. But, you know, I may do something that's, you know, more sci-fi if the mood strikes on it. But, you know, I had Last 100 Yards on the table was the last game that I really had out and, you know, played more in depth. I took photos for it and stuff like that, and, you know, was super interested to write a review up for it. But after I read the review that Players Aid did, I was like, I don't really have anything different to say. They've said it. You know, their analysis is pretty much what my analysis of it was. And, you know, I'm not going to go out there and spend, you know, 5 or 6 hours putting something together that basically says, hey, go read the Players Aid article that you already read.
Yeah.
You know, that just doesn't seem like a good investment of time.
These guys nailed it. Read theirs instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was sort of the thought. At one point I was like, okay, well, you know, Platoon Commander came out last year, and I was like, okay, well, I'll do something cool with Platoon Commander. It was a Kickstarter. I'm going to go and I'm going to do this top down like video series of it. And I started doing that and was like, the race to get content out for new games is particularly problematic for me, because I feel like I've got it in my head. I go and make the content for it, and then a game designer or somebody who was involved in playtesting is like, dude, you blew it. That's not really how this works.
Yeah.
Check this out. I'm like, oh, got it. I go and re-record the video. And so something that was like, hey, this is just meant to kind of get word out, it ends up being something that I have to go back and redo, which is not super rewarding.
And now it's work.
Yeah. And it's fun work, right? But when you get down to video content, it's just, there's just inherently more time spent. I always like to tell people, because I do video work as a part of my job from time to time, that, you know, for every minute of video that's like quality video, there's an hour behind it. And that's on something that's like simple. That's on like tutorial content video. That doesn't even talk about anything that has any sort of, you know, even just overlays and chyrons or anything that you're going to add to it. So it's one of those deals where I was like, eh. There are other people doing video stuff and doing it better who are smarter than I am about this and are making really good video content. So it wasn't even like that was particularly useful. And so I've pulled most of what's out there, unless it's something that was like in particular for a game that didn't have a lot of coverage. And I felt like, oh, I'll leave it up here, even if it's not great content. At least I'm not trying to say I'm the authoritative source. I'm like, I know everything about this game. You know, it's...
I personally won't do a ton of video stuff on the site. I don't mind streaming some things. One of the ways that we get a lot of the video content that we have with the Dragoons, quite frankly, it's Cyrano, it's Jim when he's streaming his Saturday night fights. And when you stream that stuff on YouTube afterwards, like YouTube leaves the video there. So we've still got a lot of those videos of our sure. live games. So it's not so much like a game review or anything like that. But it is, you know, some pretty solid stuff that, that Jim and the boys have played up over the past. And, you know, suddenly it's like we all got locked down because of the plague and suddenly everybody discovered Tabletop Simulator. It's like we've been doing this crap for 18 months. Like yeah. every Saturday night we're doing this. And you know, I was working.
Yeah, I joined in one night. You were doing, was it like Hearts of Oak or something that you were doing? It was this huge game of, I think, Trafalgar. It was a lot of fun watching y'all play.
Yeah, yeah. And so, well, there's a lot of those. There's only been one of them that I've actually been able to play in because I had a second job that had me working Saturday nights. And so I've got it up on the computer at work where I can sort of watch and keep an eye on, you know, jump in the chat and things like that. But I wasn't able to play on a regular basis with those guys until suddenly we all got locked down. And now... Now I've got time on my hands, and so I've been able to join in a couple. You know, I've been able to join in at least one of them. I'd like to join in some more, but that's a very different thing than what the guys at the Players Aid are doing. You know, or what Mo's doing. Mo, literally right now as we are recording this, Mo has one of the Whiskey Charlie shows going on. I think Harold's their guest tonight. So so anybody listening to this a year and a half later can go back and look up what day we were recording.
It's an Easter egg.
Yeah. It's a feature, not a bug. But the those guys are they're shooting studio video, right? I mean they've got a studio set up, they got the lights, they got the camera, they're holding stuff up, they got different camera angles, they can cut and edit some things. We're streaming stuff. Like, we're streaming a game, and you get disembodied voices talking about it as we play.
Right.
And you know, beyond that, the most video stuff that I've been involved in is not streaming, but screen recording and talking over screen recording. So, again, it's not like you're worried about camera angles and lighting and, you know, making sure right. you've got a good microphone and all that. It's sort of record what's on your screen and talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I ended up building this PVC pipe kind of, I don't know, a rig that is big enough to fit over a standard size war game map. And it has like a little floating head on it, essentially, that I can move wherever I need to. So I can do like panning shots with it and I can clip lights onto it. I guess if I wanted to get really fancy, I could buy strips of LED lights and evenly light the surface of the game playing surface. But, you know, even with that, the recording is not the hard part. I think anybody who does video, I mean, that's, you know, the recording's the easy part. Making it look like something in the end and have it be, you know, snappy enough or interesting enough to hold somebody's attention, that is like the magic.
Yeah. And you're right that the editing behind it all is a pain in the ass.
sure.
Today, well, so I recorded it yesterday, was doing the edits on it today. For a couple of years there when I was teaching college during the professional development days, I had a regular talk that I would give on using games in the classroom. And so I would do this regular talk for the PD audience, because everybody had to sign up for different PD workshops, but you got double credit if you were presenting instead of just attending. So I would do that, and I could knock out like half my PD in a two-hour block. And so I would do this presentation on games in the classroom, talk about some success stories, but I'd bring in a bunch of stuff for show and tell as well. So I'd have a whole bunch of my board games in a bag up there with me that I'd hand around the room and let people ooh and ah over them. And occasionally maybe even like sell an extra copy of something for some friends out there in the industry somewhere. What I did was I had to go back and tweak the slides a little bit. So it's me talking over slideware, but what I did is I went ahead and recorded me doing that presentation on the computer so that I had that for people, you know, that I could use as a piece of content with the Dragoons, but then I've also got that for folks in the education world if they looking for ways in which you can do games in the classroom and using some games and sims for training and learning. Here's we tear it all the way down to the theory level and build up from the theory so that, you know, you can best help match what you're trying to do with the tools available. But again, I'm not setting up cameras. I'm not rigging lights. I'm not panning camera shots like you're talking about. It's me talking over a screen, right?
Sure.
And going back and editing that still took twice as long as it did to just record the thing straight up. Yeah, it's the production end of it that kicks your ass, you know?
Yeah. I think one of the things that is difficult to convey, particularly when you're talking about creating any kind of media for wargaming, is that so much of the narrative and enjoyment is just really hard to capture. And so short of a video that records the one-off conversations that happen around the game table in conjunction with something that shows the arc of the game. And by that, I mean, you know, here's where we started. Here were some really interesting reversals that happened or tough decisions that had to be made. If you're not the player making it, I mean, there's some interest in it, but it's hard to sell the drama that you feel when you're getting ready to, you know, throw those dice into a cup or a dice tower or on the table and hopefully not knock down stacks of counters. But,
yeah,
you know, it's just hard to capture some of that. And so I think, you know, in some ways the hobby suffers from a lack of people having strong experiential media that goes along with it. And, you know, I look at the success of, in particular, like role-playing games over the last 5 years or so, and just what a huge thing Twitch streaming has become for video games and for role-playing games in particular, because we're really talking about tabletop. And that is just tough to replicate. Our games are slower. A lot of our games are follow a sort of internal dialogue about how we're doing as players versus the history.
Yep.
There's a lot of thinking about, you know, to your point earlier, like, okay, I have these engineer units. How do I deploy these in an effective way? And does the game match my expectations of what I think they should be able to do? That's a really tricky thing. Like I think if people, like, if you had like a microphone in somebody's brain, like, I feel like it would just be this long pedantic rant on like why a game doesn't work for them or does work for them. So it's really interesting watching war game media because it's tough to keep it snappy and it's tough to kind of get at those experiences that draw us back over and over again and leave us with a ton of games in our game libraries that either we're excited to play or just keep going back to over and over again for that hit of that experience.
Yeah, totally. So I've got a TV out in the office over the garage where I'm recording this. I've got a TV out here, but I don't have a cable box plugged into it. I've just got an antenna. So I get all the HD sub channels. One of the HD sub channels is an HD only network that's called TDB. And these guys do a lot of, there's no show on there that you would ever recognize. It's not like they're doing reruns of half-hour sitcoms that have been syndicated since the 80s or anything crazy like that. They do a lot of shows that lean heavily on web-produced, web-style content. And there was a while there where Tuesday nights, which is when we record our podcast, there was a weekly show on there that was who's the guy that plays Wesley Crusher from Star Trek? The guy, he's all over social media as a gamer, and his name is totally escaping
me.
Will Wheaton, thank you. This was broadcast over the air. It was Will Wheaton and like five friends playing a role playing game with Will Wheaton as the GM, and they did up the graphics really snazzy when he's talking about, okay, roll for this. They had graphics that would show the dice rolling on the screen with whatever the dice came up to for the results of these things. But they went and produced this thing with these guys sitting in a studio around a table playing this game. And I think what they probably did is they would probably, over the course of a week, play like 6 5-hour sessions, chop them up into 1 hour chunks of content or 40-minute chunks of content. And then suddenly you had an entire season of a show that they were able to record in one week.
Yeah.
But I'm you know, we're recording a war game podcast. I'm watching this role playing game play out on broadcast over the air TV. First of all, thinking the geeks won, which is really kind of cool for anybody that, you know, lived through this crap in the 80s of, you know, getting teased because you had your D&D books in your school bag. The geeks won, which is awesome. But how would you do that with a war game? And I just don't know that there's a good way to do that with a war game in any compelling fashion. I think minis help tell the story because they're a little more visually visceral.
Right.
And so that would be kind of cool. I think the overhead that goes with putting minis into play is substantial, and that's one of the reasons why, as Jim Ozarski has said on Tabletop Simulator over and over, he is a minis war gamer that wants to focus on the war game, not the minis, right? He's sure. He's not in an arts and crafts club that happens to sling some dice. He wants to play the games, but he likes the minis. And so Tabletop Simulator, where you can just copy-paste and suddenly there's an entire regiment, that's very attractive to him. And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
Telling a story like that, something more heavily produced than just what they're doing, which is streaming their TTS game, I think might carry a little bit more oomph and a little more of the drama with the talking over it and all. It's far beyond what we're going to attempt to do anytime soon, but I would be interested in seeing like a real legit video production of something like that somewhere along the way. I think there would
be. Yeah, you know, there are folks who do some streaming work for Fantasy Flight games like X-Wing, Legion has done it. I think they've done it with a couple of the card games at the Living Card Game Championships that they've had. And they do it more like esports, where they will show it, they have overlay graphics, and then they have a couple commentators talking about the decisions that folks are making and why they might be making them. And it's more social in that way because you have participation of people on the stream, but also you have some people kind of guiding the narrative and story around it.
Yeah.
One of the things that I wrote about last on Wargame HQ was this idea of like, why don't we see umpired games in commercial wargaming more frequently? Because it's worked so well for role-playing games, and there are definitely barriers to it, but I do feel like there's one, some great commercial potential if it can catch on. But I look at a game like Persian Incursion, right, where players are ultimately given briefing books that are, quite frankly, super detailed briefing books. In fact, there was an article that came out shortly after Persian Incursion was released by Clash of Arms, essentially saying that the designer may have committed a crime because of how detailed and specific he was about the process of building strike packages for the Air Force. And there was question about whether or not that had gone through a DoD review process before it was released in this commercial war game. And, you know, I don't think anything ultimately happened, at least publicly.
Larry knows where to draw those lines because he's been through that kind of stuff before. I will tell you that there were some guys at Marine Corps Intelligence at Quantico, and I'm speaking of some firsthand knowledge because I've talked to a couple of them, that they bought copies of Persian Incursion when it came out, and they were looking through it, and one of them actually walked into one of the fusion cells at Marine Corps Intel in Quantico and was like, why do these guys know more about this than we do? But Larry is nothing if not very meticulous about his note taking, and so he can show you where every open source came from that he got all of that data.
It's fascinating. And so, you know, there's that level of detail that makes that game exceptional, but it's not much of a game, right?
Oh, no, it's, apologies to Larry Bond, it's a lousy game. It's a great kit, but
yes,
you know.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly what it reminded me of. D&D used to put out these things called gazetteer box sets that had all this information about, like, a made-up kind of duchy or place or something. Right.
I have the whole line of them.
Yeah, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. And, like, they were really fantastic resources to build a game around and that sort of thing. The beauty of Persian Incursion is that it gives you that. What it's missing is this is how you run this as an umpired game. And I think if somebody could crack the code for how to build an umpired process for a game like that, it would be awesome. Because then you'd really be able to build out like teams of players against teams of other players. The actual umpire would have something to do other than just roll dice on a chart, which I think is one of the problems with umpired games for wargaming. There's not the creative component to it that there is in, say, a role-playing game, and so it doesn't feel as rewarding. But I think if you can create that rewarding experience where players have limited and imperfect information, umpire has perfect information, but they're allowed to take liberties with the things that the other players don't know and haven't commanded, that gets you to the point where I think you're building an interesting experience for everybody. And frankly, with the tools that are available digitally for remote play, that would, I think, be spectacular and bring commercial and professional wargaming somewhat closer together and allow commercial wargame companies the ability to sell content packs all the time on everything in any era.
We've got a fairly solid crew of guys who have run Double Blind Kriegspiels over at the Dragoons. We've done these a couple of different times at Origins, and the command post exercises that we run at Origins, very similar to what you're describing, we've done for the better part of, I don't know, 11 or 12 years at this point. We've missed a year or two here and there when Origins scheduling got a little screwy, but we've been pretty solid nonstop on these. The Persian Incursion kind of thing that you're talking about, you know, a refereed version of that, we did it. And we've got a handful of video from that where we shot different video snippets as a part of it. Larry Bond was there to actually see part of it. There's some footage of this that we have described on other podcasts here and there. But basically, we ran Larry Bond's thing as a cooperative team game where somebody was the head of the Israeli government, for lack of a better term, but really he was a military commander. We had somebody in charge of the ground crew and turning around the fighters, so he was responsible for what was available as you're building those strike packages. We had somebody else who was kind of the air traffic control guy that was making sure things could get through in different places. Somebody else was your intel dude. Hey, what is out there for the Iranians here and there and everywhere? And so everybody had all these different roles. We had a couple of our guys playing the Op4 as a part of that, and I got to be the referee in the middle of it all. It's one of the few where I've been the primary referee. And as we're completely disassembling Persian Incursion and like ignoring the politics track altogether, we're really tearing apart this game for what we're going to try to do. Larry and Chris walk into the room and like, hey, we just wanted to come see what you were doing. I'm like, oh, great! Like, you know, we're about to totally bastardize this game, and here comes Larry because he wants to watch. And it turned out it was one of the best games we'd ever run like that at Origins. We're all terrified to ever use Persian Incursion again because there's no way it's going to measure up to how good it went that first time, and we just don't want to be disappointed. Larry ended up having a great time. He told us on the way out, he's like, guys, this was a blast. I love this. This was so much fun. And I'm like, thank God. You know, because last thing I need is Larry Bond being pissed at me for the rest of my life. Not that he knows who I am or anything, but, you know, you don't want one of the you know, luminaries of wargaming to have a reason to hold a grudge against you. And so we had a blast with that. We've done very similar stuff at Origins over the years. Jim has been experimenting with how to do a double-blind Kriegspiel through Tabletop Simulator. Again, the challenge is streaming it where it just runs in real time with whatever your real-time commentary is going to be. Yeah. Is very different than cutting and pasting and producing and editing something together that becomes a TV show.
Yeah.
My dream state for years has been to sort of make the 30-minute TV show out of one of our CPX's 30-minute or an hour TV show. Again, it's a four-hour and change event at Origins. I would really like to make a TV show out of that because I think it would be really compelling. I just, whenever we get to Origins, we're always like two bodies short of what we need to actually do all the stuff we've got in front of us, never mind you know, graft a video crew onto us to sit there and do this. Maybe I need to find a bunch of college kids that need a project and
that's right.
and have them come along. But you're absolutely right. I think that kind of narrative storytelling, I think, would make for a very compelling video project.
Yeah, you need some kind of like conflict in decision making, right? The moment where you are having to make a critical decision, if it's all inside your head, okay, it's somewhat interesting, but if it's you against another person, or better yet, two or three people having a debate about where scarce resources are going to be spent and how, that is really, I mean, virtually all of reality TV is based on that premise. And so it doesn't have to be an amazing game.
Yeah.
What has to be amazing is the player interaction.
Well, and I think that's where having a multiplayer event that you do that with, I think you're right on there, is that having that multiplayer event moves that narrative out of an internal monologue and into an external conversation.
Yes, and, absolutely.
And so at that point, now you're able to capture that on video. It's not sort of forcing people to talk about what they're doing. Now you've actually got it happening. I think that's definitely where that would make a difference.
One of the best gaming articles that I ever read was an article that was done by, it was either The Atlantic or The New York Times, and they came to UNC Chapel Hill, and this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, when UNC was hosting the national championship for diplomacy.
Okay.
And so it was players from all over the United States, maybe even all over the world, came and played diplomacy, and it was like a week-long thing. And the article described these players and just how well they knew each other, and like the backstabbing and these conversations that were happening, and people were blowing up at each other outside of the game, even, you know, when they would go to dinner and things. And it just, yeah. It sounded completely unhinged, and I was like, yeah, I kind of get it. Like, this is what makes that game so fun. Nobody who plays at a competitive level of diplomacy shows up to Chapel Hill thinking that everybody's going to hang out together and be best friends.
Oh, God, no. Yeah.
And that was essentially what the players said in the article, and the article did a great job of just portraying that, and I felt like, this is it. This is the most honest portrayal, I think, of diplomacy that maybe anybody from a professional journalism standpoint has written and maybe ever will write.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I that's probably a very true statement. We used to have a sort of standing agreement. I played a whole bunch of diplomacy in college because it was something you could do very easily in the dorms, just using one of the common rooms in there, because you don't have to set a bunch of stuff up, right? It's one map and a bunch of wooden pieces. It's pretty easy to set up and tear down. We used to have kind of an unofficial house rule that if you were the dude who won, you had to sit out the next game. Because even if you didn't, you were dead in three turns because everybody wanted a piece of you. You know, after having won the one before, everybody wanted a piece of you. So
I always say that people who are like real big on the like, you know, I need to play golf with a person to decide what their character is like, have never played diplomacy.
Oh, God, no. No. That should be your requirement right there.
That should be part of, like, job interviews for companies. Be like, we're going to play diplomacy. And if somebody's like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, you're in.
Yeah, that as somebody going through some job interviews right now, yeah, that wouldn't be a lot of fun. Part of the problem with that, of course, is like, do you want to get hired by, you know, all the people that you just stabbed in the back, you know?
That's right. Like, on your first day, be like, oh, no, you don't get a computer, but you will get this pencil and this Navy that you screwed me with.
Yes. Here, let me throw this at you. We're getting close to an hour here. We started a little late because we were gabbing some before we ever hit record, but we're coming close to an hour here, and this late in the evening, my wife's probably wondering what happened to me anyway. So, let's go ahead and wrap it up. We're going to be a little short tonight, but like I said, we started a little late, and
sure. Let's
definitely not wait like multiple years before we do this again, particularly since we live in the same damn town.
We do, and we're both big Carolina Hurricanes fans, so I feel like we got to get to a Canes game if the hockey season ever gets back up and running again.
It'll happen. It's just a question of when. You know what would be really fun is if we get Mo to come out here and join us, since he does color commentary for his local hockey team.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome.
Maybe we can get – so, Mo, if you're listening, hop on a jet, get out here. Let's wait till the season starts again. One of these days, so, you know, when I had originally gotten in touch with you about, hey, let's get together and do a podcast, I was talking about let's go over to Gamers Armory and record it. We'd actually done a couple of them live from over there. Not, we didn't stream it live. We recorded them over there. Sure. Whenever Jim Werbeneth is in town, we meet up at Gamers Armory and we go record a podcast over there because I want to catch him while he's in town. And so we've done a couple. And you would think that having a game store in the background would be a big distraction. On the audio, it's not really a distraction. You can sort of hear the hum of some activity in the background. You can tell there's something going on, that you're on site somewhere. But it's not so much that it's a distraction from us being able to, like, have a conversation about the games. It's worked out really well. I've been surprised.
Yeah, I can definitely picture that. I like the ambient noise probably helps set the scene, too, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's not something you do at a game convention because those are just too damn loud.
Right.
But a game store, even on Minis night, the game store really wasn't too bad. You know, occasionally you'd hear a cheer go up across the room, but otherwise it wasn't too bad. We could do it. So maybe we can get Scott to sit down and join us for one of these.
Yeah, he's always super interesting. Now he's got his new role with MMP, so that's definitely noteworthy and interesting.
Yeah, now we just got to make sure he's in town when we want to do this.
So. Exactly.
Right. Keith, it was great to finally have a conversation with you after a couple of years of interacting online. And
I agree.
Had no idea you were the dude behind Games on Table. So that was my big thing I learned tonight. I was a member at the Game Box for a while and didn't realize that you were the Lord Overseer of that site. So I know Callendale was running the site, and I know some of the drama of what happened behind it all and why it kind of fell apart. Not a topic to rehash here, of course, but. I didn't realize you were the dude behind Games on Tables. So that's
absolutely. Cool. And I've had lots of different website projects over the years. I enjoy it. It's a great hobby, and it keeps me engaged with the community and building stuff that I like and writing about a hobby that I really enjoy. And so even if people don't read it, I enjoy writing it, and hopefully people find it useful in the end. And that's really all you can ask for.
Yeah. And I think a lot of these projects start out as, hey, I just want to write down what I'm thinking about with these things so I can remember it all for myself later. And then you start sharing it with other people, and then people actually take an interest. And, like, that's the coolest thing of all, is that other people are interested enough in something you want to say that you're like, really? What I want to say? But
yeah.
Go with it, you know? So it happens to work out. Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. This was really cool. Audience, thank you for joining us through this season of Mention and Dispatches. We're going to take a couple months off. Normally, it is convention season for us over the summer, where we're doing some stuff for conventions, either prepping for or attending or reporting from. Not a ton of conventions happening this summer, thanks to the plague, but we may have a couple of tricks up our sleeves here at the Dragoon, so you might see an opportunity to get involved in some virtual game days with us. We're still firming up some plans, but we think we've got a couple of interesting ideas that we hope you're able to join us for. So on behalf of the Armchair Dragoons, thank you very much for joining us this season of Mention and Dispatches, and we'll catch up with you again in the fall with our next season of the podcast. So take care, everybody. Keep gaming.